Hello, everyone. Welcome to Setter Talk. I am your host, Kyle Warren. This podcast is sponsored by Embark Vet and Dr. Tim's Pet Food. Embark Vet is a DNA testing company focused on helping breeders and purebred dog enthusiasts understand and improve the genetic health of their dogs. Embark's DNA test provides a comprehensive assessment of your dog's genetic health, genetic diversity, and physical traits. Embark's DNA testing process was created in partnership with Cornell University College of Veterinary Medicine, and test results are accepted by OFA and other leading canine health organizations. To learn more, visit embarkvet.com/breeders. And by Dr. Tim's Pet Food, created by veterinarian and accomplished musher Dr. Tim Hunt. Dog food formulas promoting stamina, endurance, and performance through proper nutrition. Dr. Tim's has been fueling champions for many years in the Iditarod, the field trial circuit, and hardworking hunting dogs all across North America. To learn more about the trusted source of nutrition for the canine athlete, visit drtims.com. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Setter Talk. I'm your host, Kyle Warren. Our guest today is Andy Weick. Andy lives in upstate New York, and he's a passionate upland hunter and biologist. Super happy to get him on the show. We've been trying to connect for a couple of years, and timing finally was on our side to make it happen. So, Andy, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Kyle. It's good to be here.
Yeah. So why don't you just give our listeners a little bit of background on yourself before we dive into some dog and bird related conversations?
Sure. I'll start with kind of the professional educational background. I've done a lot of work with, I'm a wildlife biologist and a forester. I've done a lot of work with rough grouse and woodcock. And so I did my undergraduate work at the University of Maine, double majored in forestry and wildlife there. And then I worked around the kind of, especially the Northeast quite a bit with waterfowl work. And then I got into, had some opportunities to get into working with woodcock and especially woodcock at the Moosehorn National Wildlife Refuge in Eastern Maine. For a while, I was at the state of Maine. I was the upland and migratory game bird program leader there, and that was great because that kind of combined my forestry and wildlife backgrounds, and I just loved that job. But I had an opportunity to go to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as a refuge biologist at the Moosehorn National Wildlife Refuge over on the New Brunswick border. And of course, that's the woodcock refuge. That's what it's best known for, is all the work that has been done there over the years, all the research on woodcock, biology and habitat needs. So that was a great fit. Love that. And then about 13 years ago or so, I moved to New York State, and I'm in the Finger Lakes Southern Tier area of New York. And during that time, for about 10, 11 years, I was with the Rough Grouse Society as a regional biologist covering the Northeast region, as well as a bit of the South. So,
cool. Wow. Yeah. That's awesome. I, obviously you and I mean, we've shook hands and, briefly chatted, at some Rough Grouse Society banquets in the past at our local chapter there in upstate New York. But that's awesome. I didn't know that you. So did you grow up in Maine? Are you a Mainer?
I'm not a Mainer. Okay. I think my kids are Mainers because one of them was born in Bangor, Maine, and then the other one was born out in Calais, Maine. So I think the rule applies that,
okay,
if you're born there, you're yeah, from there. But I was hatched in Connecticut, Northwestern,
okay,
Connecticut.
And gotcha. Yeah. So always a Northeastern boy though. So
we fly the the Boston Red Sox and Boston Bruins flags around here. So
yeah.
Sideways cool looks, but
Tell me about your upbringing in terms of what got you into the outdoors that led to upland hunting that led you running a red setter, you know?
Yeah. So I was a farm boy. We had a dairy farm, and then got into growing a small orchard. So I was out in the woods, in or on the farm, beyond the farm, since I can remember. And we had dogs, but they were always, a good mutt, cow dog slash everything dog. I always wanted to get a bird dog of my own. Well, actually, I always wanted to get a Labrador Retriever, and so I had stacks of, books of training retrievers and stuff. So, and I always put off getting a dog, because I was in college. I was, traveling around, for work and stuff. And then finally, once I was out of college, I was working as a seasonal wildlife technician at Moosehorn National Wildlife Refuge, on a woodcock study, and there was an opportunity. There's a grad student working there, and he was getting an English setter pup, and he said, "Hey, any of you guys want to get a pup? There's one more pup in this litter." And in that litter happened to be one that Andy Ammon had, and Andy Ammon was a upland game bird and woodcock guru from Michigan, the Michigan DNR. And so he had this, so that some people think of them as the Michigan DNR dogs. They're basically Wichsel line, but they were outcrossed all over the place. There were, there's Ryman in there, Ghost Train, which was a field trial dog, he was in there. So anyway, but they were, bird dogs, good bird dogs. So, and I was like, I always wanted a lab, so obviously, so I was like, damn, I'll get one of these. So that poor dog had to go through all that retriever training, and man, I well and I learned so much, because it's like, a setter cannot, for the life of it, mark a bird, a dummy or a bird or whatever. I mean, it knows the direction. It has no idea about how far away it is, though. But that dog, he turned out to be a great retriever. I could handle him to blind retrieves, like multiple blinds and stuff, because I worked so hard at him. But it was so, I looking back and realizing now, after having trained a lab, that what I was up against. But that was, he was a good dog. He was a grouse dog, woodcock dog, duck dog. So that was my start. And then the next one I got was probably about 7 years later, when another biologist and I produced a litter from my dog and his bitch. And it was, again, it was the Wixel line, and so I got my next one that way, and he turned out to be a really good bird dog as well, good grouse dog. But they were very different. The first one was more of a tracker, fantastic retriever. The next one I got involved in NAVDA, and everybody was saying, "Don't do anything with retrieving. Put that off till afterwards." Until he was like a year old, and I should have gone with my instincts, and I should have, worked him like I normally would have. He turned out to be a terrible retriever. He had some spectacular retrieves, because, and they stand out because they were so few, but they were wonderful. It was like, he came back with this live wingtip bird that you'd never thought, would have. So anyway, so that was my next one. And then the third one, so, and actually, these were long-lived dogs, so there's a lot of space in between. So I had those two, and then when the second one was still kicking, and he was getting pretty old, then I decided I'd always been, you know, looking, thinking about Irish setters and wondering about them. And I did my homework, emailed a lot of people, talked to a lot of people. And what put me over the edge, because I was, you know, all the red setters were all, you know, the field bred dogs were all field trial dogs for the most part. Most of them were field trial dogs, horseback field trial dogs. And I was always afraid of that. People told me, you know, stay away from field trial dogs or whatever. And, but I talked to this one guy in Vermont, who had a couple of red setters, and he was a very avid bird hunter, and his brother from Maine was a very avid bird hunter. And he said the best grouse dog we've ever hunted over has been my Ruby dog. And so I said, okay, so that kind of put me over the edge. Mm-hmm. And actually that brother from Maine was just on a podcast of yours not too long ago. So very avid bird hunter. I think you know who I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And so, okay. So I ended up getting one from, Berg Brothers out in, Minnesota. And the one thing with all of my dogs to date is I've been able to live near grouse, and as puppies, I've had them in the woods, you know, right from a very early age, just learning how to handle birds. And so this red setter I got, it was a male named Brody, and he was from some real, I wish, one big regret I have is not studying him, because his genetics were really good, but he turned out to be my best grouse dog, and excellent retriever, really good at finding dead birds, handled grouse from a very young as a puppy. So I was really tickled with him. And then more recently, just probably two, three years ago, I got another red dog. I was looking, because I waited really kind of a long time between dogs after the first red. He was still an old, I still had him, but he was getting old. And I was starting to guide hunters in New York, and I needed more dog power. And so I got a started, well, I should say an older young dog with a red setter from Wisconsin. And I was on a trial basis. Like, if he works out, great. If he doesn't, I'll send him back. Well, he started pointing grouse for me right away that summer. And so I actually used him for guiding in the fall, and he turned out to be pretty good. So I've got him. He's 4.5 now. And then last year, I went for the first time to the Red Setter, the National Red Setter Field Trial Club has two national field trials every year. So this one last year was out in Illinois. So I went out there. I wanted to meet a bunch of people that bred Red Setters and see a bunch of dogs. And I kind of knew some of the dogs. I wanted to see, you know, look them in the eye and inspect them and see them run. And I had no intention of buying a dog, but, I noticed staked out. I saw three different females, young dogs, year old dogs staked out, and they looked identical, and they all were nice and calm. And you know, I really like to check out their temperament, and I saw them run. I saw them handle bird. I mean, they're only quail, but I saw them work birds. Yeah. And I was talking with a trainer out there as we were walking along, you know, by a bunch of dogs, and I said, I really like those dogs, and he told me they're full sisters, they're all litter mates, and he said there was another repeat breeding, and he thought there was another pup, and I was like, wow, great, because you know, rather than get you know, a pup from a dog you really like, if you can get from a repeat breeding of a dog you really like, you're ahead of the game. And so I did. So there was one pup left. And so right then and there, I said, yep, I'll take it. And so I have her. That's a little bitch. and she just turned a year last month. And this past fall, I had a pretty full calendar for guiding. And one day early in the season, one of the guys I was guiding was, he's like, I'd really like to see your pup run. And I was like, all right. So I put her down, and he killed his first grouse over her point. So that was, so she started as a pup, you know, I started using her for guiding because she seemed really, really good, really mature in the woods. So,
yeah. Cool.
So that's my road. That's where I am at present. And this year I probably have another one or two pups coming. Whether or not I keep them, that's another question.
Sure. Well, that's awesome. Where was that trial that you went to for the Red Setters again?
Yeah, that was out in Illinois. So that was a year ago now. It was last March. And then this year I went down, there was the spring trial. It was actually winter. I went down to North Carolina for the Red Setter trial and actually ran my pup. First time I'd ever, you know, in a walking derby stake. She was only a puppy, but they didn't have a puppy stake. So I ran her in the walking derby, and it's a game. You know, it's like, I'm glad I did it, because actually part of the purchase agreement on that pup is I need to run her in the futurity for as a 2-year-old dog next year. And actually that's supposed to be off of horseback. So I've got to do,
some horseback lessons.
Yeah. Well, actually I ran a couple of the braces down. I rode a couple of the braces of the horseback braces just, so that was cool. So I'm not, you know, however, it'll be new and different, so I'll have to actually run my dog off of a horse. And for my purposes, I don't care if she doesn't, if she can't compete at that, because I don't necessarily care if she's out 400 yards, you know, or actually 400 might be pretty short, because she's a woods dog, and so I don't expect her to be reaching for the horizons.
And unless you're riding a donkey, you know, I don't think you're gonna make it through the grouse woods on horseback. So that's cool. That's very cool. So diving in a little bit, bridging the dog specifics into hunting and your career, does Maine, I have a biologist client, seems Eric Bloomberg. I don't know if you know him.
Oh, I know him quite well.
So I haven't had many conversations with him, but he seems like a real great guy. And I don't know his exact job. I don't know if he's a teacher, but I see him, you know, out with students a lot, you know, and he does a lot with woodcock. Does Maine has a banding program of sorts?
Not really. So I did my English setters that I had when I was living in Maine, I did use those for banding for woodcock brood finding, but those, it was because there were specific, research projects.
Gotcha.
So Eric, he's a professor at UMaine in the wildlife department. And his thing, there's one other professor there that kind of, they work together a bit, but his deal is game birds and migratory game birds. So both. So he's done. He's had students working on ruff grouse, and he's had students working on woodcock research. So all this recent woodcock migration study with the satellite transmitters. Those are Eric's students that he's co-advising on those projects. So he's like
a guy that maybe I should have on the show.
Oh, absolutely. You got to have Eric on there. He told me, we were talking dogs, you know, so prior to this setter that he got from you, he has had, his dad was, he's from Wisconsin. His dad pretty sure it's Wisconsin. Anyway, yep. his dad had bred German Shorthair pointers, and mm-hmm. so he had German Shorthair pointer. But now he's a setter guy.
Yeah,
he told me, yeah, I'm a setter guy now.
Yeah, so. That's cool. Very cool. So it's just research projects he's doing with his students in college. I got it.
So if he has an opportunity to do some woodcock brood work, I'm sure he'll take advantage of that opportunity.
Yeah, absolutely. As far as particular research projects, whether it be university, your job with Rough Grouse Society, or other, is there any particular highlighted project or projects that you could share with us that you've done in the past with whether it be woodcock or grouse?
Let's see. I mean, a lot of the work we did at Moosehorn, either when I was, a technician in my younger days, like when I got my first pup there, mm-hmm. that was some pretty good stuff. And that kind of led to probably the one that I had most involvement with and where I could use a dog was when I was with the state of Maine as the upland game bird biologist there. And at the university, there was a grad student who was doing some woodcock genetics work and looking at, so we'd actually, if we had found nests with our dogs, we did some brood searching and woodcock hen searching with the dogs. And if we had found a nest, we'd calculate, candle the egg or float the egg to see approximate when is it going to hatch. And then we would try to capture. So we would try to capture that hen, draw blood sample from her, capture any singing males in the area with mist nets in the evening when they're doing their courtship display and take blood samples from the males and then try to capture the brood after they hatched and take a blood sample from each of the chicks in the brood. So that was a pretty neat little study.
Yeah.
And that was, and it was really cool to be able to use my dog, to employ my dog on that. And then actually that was the first dog I had, but then the next dog, English setter, I was able to use on a woodcock study, it was a survival study during the hunting season in Maine. Well, it was actually in a number of states, but I worked in Maine on that one.
Mm-hmm.
We'd put radio transmitters, on birds in September. Typically we try to catch as many as we could in September on a study area where hunting was allowed and on a study area where hunting was not allowed. And then compare, mortality of those birds over, the next couple of months. And that was replicated in a number of states, to look at the effects of hunting on basically does it have a population effect on woodcock survival? And what was neat was, some of the transmitters, it was the first year we did that study, the manufacturer of the transmitters did too good a job putting them together and the batteries were really good. And so those batteries lasted, oh my goodness, probably 6 months. So from September, or even more than that, September when we put the tags on and then the woodcock, did its thing in Maine for a couple of months, then flew south to wherever because we lost track of them because they weren't the satellite ones, all, down to whatever, Louisiana, North Carolina, wherever, came back in the spring. So we had a couple of hens come back in the spring and their transmitters were still working. And, just by luck, I happened to be scanning through I was curious, scanning through the frequencies with a receiver on the study area and picked up the signal of one of our woodcock and was able to, and then she hatched out a brood. So it was pretty neat to see the, so these transmitters weren't having any negative effect on these birds. They were doing everything that they were supposed to do as far as successfully migrating south, migrating north, courting, laying eggs, nesting, raising a brood of chicks. So that was pretty good stuff.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. I have a bunch of little notes here to spark a few different subjects, but I guess one that I'd start with is, and I mean, I guess I'm not the biggest reader of data, but certainly I speak to a lot of different biologists, and between data and just like their experience on the ground and lots of hunters' experience on the ground, you know, sometimes weeding fact from fiction can be difficult, and maybe there's not always a black and white answer to it. But one thing that I always feel that I hear and I see a lot that says like hunting pressure doesn't affect the bird numbers. I don't know what, you know, data you've participated in and or read or been taught, you know, or your experience, how you feel about that. I mean, I've always having grew up in New York and hunted there for 30 years, and the serious grouse hunters like all know the same places, because we have New York has amazing grouse hunting if you have access to private land, especially. But all those great public land honey holes, like you see the same 10 guys there all the time, you know. And
that's funny.
You know, and so I don't know, growing up there my whole life, having had a lot of private land access, where like I know I was the only human hunting grouse there, and just seeing, depending upon my own self-control and self-regulation or lack thereof, you know, throughout my life, you know, population swings and taking cycles into account. I mean, I, being a lifetime New York grouse hunter, I have a really hard time believing that hunting pressure does not affect bird populations, because I always joke, while I out here in Michigan, Wisconsin, I have literally hundreds of covers that I try to distribute myself in throughout the season. Like you don't want five of me in your immediate area, you know, with a pack of 10 dogs that's hunting sun up to sundown every day of the season, no matter how much these people are spreading around their time in different covers. You know, I've always felt that birds can only avoid so many shots, you know, and, yeah. You know, plus just the pressure that we put, the physical pressure we put on them, that I can't imagine it doesn't have an effect on how they are able to evade other predators so much. So being a New Yorker and hunting in the Northeast, where maybe Maine being an exception, though I know they can have some violent cycle changes over the decades as I've heard from a good number of my people up that way. But having lived where you live, you know, I'm sure you have an opinion and, you know, perhaps some fact on hunting pressure, and maybe it varies from species between woodcock and grouse. I'm more of a, very much so, a grouse hunter. So maybe give us your experience, opinion, and data that you have in terms of the Northeast specifically, because it's something out here in the Lake States that I think a lot of biologists and certainly hunters feel that, you know, a lot of hunting pressure in the same locations, despite a 5-bird limit, is just okay. And I just can't swallow that myself, whether it's just my opinion or field experience. But please take that carrot and run with it.
Yeah. So the research that's been done, the kind of the most recent, and some of it's not that recent anymore, research that's been done on that. So in the, for with woodcock, so I mentioned that hunting mortality study, that was in the late 90s, early 2000s. Actually, was it, or maybe a little bit? No, that's right. That's when it was. And so there was one study done in the Northeast, and the other study was done in Michigan, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. And they were almost, they weren't quite done at the same, they overlapped, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they were multi-year studies on woodcock during the hunting season. And in the East, New England, New York, Pennsylvania, the results, the conclusions were that hunting didn't have a significant or identifiable effect on woodcock survival over the hunting season period in the, you know, while they on the northern area where they were studied.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically the woodcock that were in unhunted areas died of other things at about the same rate that the woodcock in the hunted areas died.
Mm-hmm.
So in the but that's a different hunter base and different environment than you have in the Lake States. And in the Lake States, they found that in some areas, hunting did have a negative effect. And that's because of kind of what you're alluding to is some places were really popular and people, you know, repeatedly hunted those areas, and not just like one person, but, you know, multiple people. They were popular hunting areas and they got hammered.
Sure. Yeah.
So that's kind of what you would expect.
Mm-hmm.
With grouse, I don't know. I know there's Eric Blomberg and his crew did a study, is the most recent one on grouse, and that was in Maine. And I don't recall, and I actually killed one of those grouse when I was hunting. I was like, dang it, I got a transmitter. I don't think there was a significant effect of hunting, on grouse in that study in Maine. But Maine is got a lot of habitat, not a ton of hunters, really. Mm-hmm. You're rarely elbow to elbow with anybody. I remember one time, this was a little bit different. I was driving along opening day grouse, woodcock, and ducks opened on the same day in the north zone in Maine back when I was there. And so we'd go hunting ducks for a couple hours and then go hunt birds. And driving out to go hunt birds, it's like plan A, nope, someone's there. Plan B, nope, someone's there. Plan C. So I got down to plan E or F before I found an a spot where I didn't see a truck. But that was really unusual to see that many hunters out for Maine. You usually have lower densities of hunters. Let's see. In New York. There was a study. This is a fairly older study now. It's probably back in the early 2000s or so. They had a couple different study areas in New York looking at effects of hunting on survival of grouse. And they found no significant effect.
Mm-hmm.
However, I think so now, so that's kind of what the research has shown. But in my personal experience, for instance, I owned a place a few years ago in New York here, and we had woodcock and we had grouse on the property. It was like 65 acres. And so I had my own training birds, right? I wouldn't touch those birds, except I would go one hunt with my kids. My kids were just like little, you know, rugrats at the time. They were like, you know, 6 years old, 7, 8 years old. So that was the one day it was like, okay, bring them out. They had their little their little toy side by sides, and we went out and so they could tag along and they could see the dog find and point a bird, see a bird flush up, hopefully see their mighty dad knock it down, the dog retrieve it. So we would do that one hunt every year because it was an area where we didn't really have migrants coming through. It was, we had our local breeding woodcock.
Yeah.
We didn't have migrants coming through and we had, but we did have grouse there and, but it was the same way with the grouse. We wouldn't, you know, if I killed one or two birds, that was it. Cause it was, you know, I protected my backyard. Let's see, where was it going to go with that?
I mean, certainly my hunting experiences, when I think New York, you know, in terms of public land, you know, if we look at like, so New York has a handful of nice WMAs, you know, from, you know, a few hundred acres to several thousand acres. And, you know, some of them have some more like timeless habitat and others like are long overdue to be more managed. You know all too well about those. And but there are birds there. And I mean, I've hunted them for 30 years, you know, and I don't know. I while there's the habitat there, and I just like compare it to like, you know, like all these private land farms that are, you know, a 10-minute drive from these WMAs that was granted permission to hunt on just through knocking doors. Some people saying yes, some people saying no. And like how those populations, knowing that like I'm one of, or the only person hunting there, like just like we're unchanged because of me taking like two birds from that, you know, 150-acre farm and seeing it next year, to the WMAs where like I see the same 10 trucks, like who's getting to that cover first kind of thing, you know, amongst the serious grouse hunters, throughout my life. I have a hard time, like everybody's chasing the same last drummer, you know, on that hillside. And I just have a hard time believing that like we didn't do that, you know?
Right. And so like, and that's a problem. So recently is probably, I was involved with, there were several nonprofit conservation organizations involved with working with New York DEC, our wildlife agency, to get a young forest initiative started in the state. And so that was like, I think Pheasants Forever and the Turkey Federation, RGS, and a whitetail group as well, and as well as like Nature Conservancy and Audubon, and so the goal there was to get a like 10% of the forest cover on the wildlife management areas. The state wildlife management areas, as opposed to the state forest, that's a different beast, to be 10 years or younger in age class. So basically going in and cutting every year, cutting more trees on the wildlife management areas to produce good, you know, young forest thicket habitat. And hopefully they're not going to go back after it only grows for 10 years and cut it again. Hopefully they just keep, cause you know that the value of a regenerating stand, it only just starts getting good at 10 years.
Sure.
And then it starts to fall off, you know, after 15 to 20 years, depending on the site. So, so that was just started like 5 years ago. So that program, if anybody expects to see any effect from that program now, then they don't understand, because it's not gonna, that program isn't gonna really kick in and show significant effect until 15, 20 years down the road. That's like, you know, one or two dog lives, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
That's and nobody's legs are getting any younger either.
So it's a false hope to expect, you know, results now. In fact, you should expect, all things equal, that the populations based on habitat should decline, mm-hmm. Or maybe stay even over, you know, now that we're through our fifth year or whatever, now hopefully you would expect populations to, production of grouse and woodcock to pick up or at least maintain going forward. So I would expect over the past 5 years that numbers based on habitat alone would fall. There's basically one wildlife management area in the state that's had a fairly long-term grouse habitat program, mm-hmm. and they've done grouse drumming counts there. Uh-huh. And basically they've maintained those drumming counts are flat. They're just maintaining. Mm-hmm. And that's really what that's kind of what you would expect if with a long-term habitat program is to maintain the population. That's kind of what you'd expect. And so that's what that's done. So this year, in most years, I don't hunt the wildlife management areas hardly at all. This year, I never stepped foot on a wildlife management area.
Yeah.
And so I'm not seeing people. There's, you know, maybe on a national forest. I heard one dog bell. Mm-hmm. So I'm not seeing people out there. And I don't know. They might be at those same five places you're talking about. You know, kind of standing around somebody's tailgate commiserating.
Yeah.
There's a lot of acreage on the state forests.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think, again, I always tell everybody, you know, I think New York's a great grouse hunting state. You have to work to find and develop your covers a little bit more. And again, if you can develop access to private land, it's a major game changer. I think the state has the potential to have a good future based on what's there. You know, if I kind of look at my life, like for me, I've always felt that like high years where I've hunted in New York were on the sixes. So like, yeah, I mean, like 96, 06, 2016, like each one of those years. And I've talked to people, you know, about this in shows before and stuff. And sure, you know, you become a better hunter, you get better dogs, you know, all those things come into effect. But yeah, hunting the same farm, you know, same farms, you know, my whole life. And like, it's like, objective covers with the Hawthorn Grove, the orchard, the hemlocks near the creek. Like, you know, yeah, there needs to be intelligence involved to a degree, but by the same token, like that's where the birds are on that property, you know? And over that span of, you know, time, with several cycles, like 2016 was, I tell you, the best bird numbered year I ever had in New York. You know, and so like it's gotten better in places where they like cycle as per classic description, you know, definitely kind of did its thing there. But one of the things that I wonder in like these WMAs, you know, sure, the if you build it, they will come kind of thing we want to believe in. And I certainly think in the Lake States that can happen given the just hundreds of thousands of acres of contiguous habitat where the birds could literally pack their bags and just keep walking until they find something. Something that I've always wondered, and I've brought it up amongst dog people, but not necessarily talked about it at length with a scientist. And that is, what's your opinions on, maybe we have to go to a state besides New York, but maybe more like PA, you know, where they, you know, have very much sang the wild West Nile virus blues, you know. I don't know, my thoughts are in like North Carolina, another former, you know, very avid hunting, you know, yesteryear grouse hunting location, with their lower populations. Like, to me, I mean, I just think of it like on a dog breeding, and I race homing pigeons at pigeon breeding level. Like, do they, like, how do they have the genetic base for those wild birds to repopulate and be healthy?
Well,
you know,
yeah. So like you mentioned North Carolina, I think 23, you know, January, February, maybe December. I know some people that were finding, it was a good year down there. I was really surprised. I mean, I kind of was like a little envious. It's like, what are they doing down there? Let's see. So I think they've got, in some places, they've got like, I think probably like West Virginia, North Carolina have, let's see, Eastern Tennessee. They've got they still have the seed, seed population. They need, you know, Armageddon Habitat Project.
Yeah. Yes. Right.
And so there was, I think it was in Kentucky, there was on some national forest, there was some wild spread, serious wildfire just a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of thing.
Yeah.
In lieu of, you know, aggressive timber sales that they need, because that whole habitat bottleneck is really mm-hmm. hurting across, you know, in the really big picture. So like, but you know, like northern New England's doing quite well with timber. I've seen a fair bit of good looking stuff in Pennsylvania. Maybe not necessarily for grouse, but the woodcock ought to be benefiting from it. Pennsylvania is convinced about West Nile virus. I don't know that any other state is really, whether they've been affected or they've able to detect an effect of West Nile virus. Because I know it's everywhere, right? We find it in grouse everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
I've got three samples I've got to send in for grouse from this past season still.
Yeah. I think New York, New York, I mean, the first time I remember hearing about it was, around like 2000 or something was when, you know, like wild birds like blue jays and I had Heather Shaw, a former colleague of yours on the show a while back. And we were talking about, you know, West Nile and stuff at the time when I interviewed her. Michigan was in the middle of their kind of concluding their West Nile study, but it's, I don't know. I mean, obviously, again, the New York birds seem to like overcome its survival of the fittest kind of thing. Certainly out here, 2 years after, I was finding a very good number of sick birds. I had the best year I had out here in 9 seasons, you know. So, and obviously, we have the habitat quantity. Yeah. You know, the genetic diversity, we have everything to make it. So what every biologist would hope that Mother Nature could sustain, you know, a viral attack like that. Obviously there's a lot of variables that some we know, some we don't know that go into the survival of them there. But I've always just wondered about the genetic future of the grouse populations up and down the East Coast. You know, I know, was it Missouri? There was some state that they tried to bring in rough grouse, but it might've just been like a lack of habitat and high pressure, you know, predator issue or something. But
yeah, Missouri tried to do it, I think, a couple times now. In the most recent time, you know, just 3 years ago or so, you know, it was being talked about because they were bringing some in from either Minnesota or Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And they had on private land, a habitat cooperative, mm-hmm. but I don't know if people really appreciate how much and how great the habitat needs to be when you're going to bring in new birds.
Yeah.
Cause they've got to have like the absolute best habitat, because they're plunked in an area where the predators, they don't know the area. They don't know where the predators are. They don't know what the predators are necessarily. Mm-hmm. They don't know where the escape places are. So they've got to learn really fast in order to survive.
Yeah.
So that's always a tough thing to do.
Yeah.
And to your point, maybe the genetics weren't right.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't know how diverse genetically grouse are anyway. I don't know whether it really makes a difference how many
branches they have on their tree.
Yeah, right. Are they are they a really tightly bred line, or are they, you know, outcrossed all over the place? Let's see. Oh, but that's one thing about kind of getting back to hunting pressure too.
Mm-hmm.
Is people have to take a little responsibility for their own actions.
Absolutely.
You know, whether would you know, kind of as a philosophical notion is, would you rather have your behavior be dictated by someone else, or would you rather, you know, be responsible for your own behavior? Would you rather have laws dictate everything you can do, or would you use a little common sense? And it's like, look, I'm looking around and I'm seeing all these trucks, and I want to, you know, I kill one bird and I still want to stay and try to kill another bird.
Yeah.
Or maybe you go knocking on some doors, or you go do some exploring. I try every fall to just find new places. Sometimes I only have, you know, 45 minutes. I want to run a dog.
Sure.
So those places near me, I'm not going to be killing. They're not my birds. They're public land birds, but it doesn't make any sense for me to be killing those birds.
Sure.
Because I want to run the dogs on them again.
Sure.
So that's the kind of thinking that I do. And I kind of,
and it's a challenge, because you could have like-minded individual like yourself that lives an hour from you coming to hunt your local birds, while you're going an hour from yourself to go hunt some other local birds. You know what I mean?
Well, that's why I always keep an eye out for, like, if I'm seeing a lot of hunters, well, I stop going there, you know, or I see, you know, not even a lot of hunters.
Sure.
I just, like, well, I'll find someplace. There's, because around here, I'm just not seeing people out.
Yeah. Well, that's a blessing. I mean, obviously we want our, you know, our hunters are our environmental and conservation support, but it's always the double-edged sword, right? You know, I mean, the biggest problem is not that we have too many hunters. It's just that we get them in concentrated areas, like a WMA in the east, and out here, you know, we get all over the country, I guess, for all species, but we get our hot spotted towns and all that kind of stuff. And I think that, you know, that obviously plays into it, but I certainly, while I love to always have a bird in every one of my dog's mouths that are working hard, and they really enjoy having that bird in their mouth. You know, I especially a state like New York, I mean, I literally have only gotten a limit one time, and it was my last year as a New York State resident living there. You know, lots of two bird and lots of three bird days throughout my life, but never a four bird day. But I just don't feel like there should be a four bird limit in 2023 in New York State. You know, you get three guys you know, that go out together with two dogs and a pocket cover, and they literally could like wipe out that pocket cover, you know.
But there you go again, though. It's like, come on, guys, smarten up. It's a pocket cover.
Yeah, no, no.
Because if I like, I rarely, other than guiding, I haven't hunted a whole day. You know, I go out for maybe 2 hours or something like that, you know, kind of on the upside. But I can think of some places where if I had five pups, you know, and that I want to get, you know, and I want to develop as grouse dogs. And I know some areas that I could hunt all day. And if I could get, you know, four of those, you know, if they do everything right, and I am able to, which is to knock down a bird for four of them, which would be an act of God.
Yeah.
then I would like to have that opportunity, but you know, it's like, I don't have four pups, you know, but, but
and anything, the but driving I do, you have to do it, you know, is,
I mean, you get up into some areas that, you know, especially on some private land that you could do that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, but does anybody do it? I don't hear about
not
it.
Not many, no, for sure.
I don't hear about it. And I kind of wonder, so some folks that I know, you know, so we've got this survey, flush count survey, or hunter, you know, flushing survey for the state for woodcock and grouse, and you keep track of your calendar. I got to send mine in. But I looked at some data, and like in some places the average is one per hour, and I'm thinking, man, that's tough.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really tough, because when you get one per hour, that means somebody's getting three per hour and somebody's getting zero per hour.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of makes you wonder why you keep going back to those places if you're not finding any birds. And, but also it's like, well, it's interesting, but you know, in order for me to kill a bird, I may have to encounter nine birds. The dog handles six birds. I see three birds. I shoot it, you know, you know what I mean? It's like, you only bag a small percentage of the birds you encounter.
Yeah. A high bag day there's a winning lottery ticket element to it.
I was just looking, you mentioned, you know, when the high numbers of grouse counts were for you, when you were hunting in New York, and I was thinking 2016. So I looked back, cause there was a couple days that, a friend and I, took some folks hunting from out of state, and I was looking back, it's like, was it 2016? It was 2014.
Uh-huh.
And it was like, so 2 days, one day was 35 different grouse, and one day was like 26 or something like that. It was in the upper 20s.
Yeah.
Plus woodcock.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's possible. There were young birds then, during that season for sure. And the funny thing is I think everybody killed a bird, like four people, everybody killed a bird, and maybe somebody killed two or something like that. Grouse got woodcock.
Yeah.
I mean, but to me, that's like a stellar hunt.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. Absolutely. That's very, very good New York hunting. Yeah, it's hard. You know, I think these like flush rate data, you know, talk about all the time of like, you know, you can always skew your numbers, right? You know, it's like if you've been hunting for a while, you have your good covers, you know, you know, you can make those numbers. But I mean, you know, we need the report card that has like, okay, you've hunted these 20 different locations. You've hunted an hour in these 20 different locations. What's that flush rate, you know, average, you know?
But also, you can go one day to a covert, and then you can go, you know, the next day or a few days later to the same covert and have a vastly different experience.
Oh yeah. Yeah. A different hour of the day. I've done experiments here, you know, where I'm like, oh man, this is a great spot. This is beautiful. Like there's no way that there are not birds here, and find one. And then like, you know what? I'm going to go back there, you know, for an afternoon hunt, you know, and you find 10, you know.
I was with some friends in Wisconsin one time. I was driving through and they were at bird camp, and I stopped in the evening, and I had my English setter, the second one, who was a good grouse dog, and a couple of the guys were just like delirious. They were like, "You wouldn't believe the new covert we found. We lost track of how many grouse we flushed. It was 50. It was more than 50. I mean, they were just like, they were just like drunk on birds." And the dog they had was like not a really good bird dog. It didn't matter.
Yeah, right. So,
and one of them said, "I'm bringing you there tomorrow. We're going to go there. I'll show you." So we brought my dog Spy, and we hunted for a few hours hard. We found one bird. So the flush count, and then this past fall, October was lousy with the second half of October or so. It was so warm. It was tough on the dogs, and the birds were just,
not moving.
You couldn't detect them. They were up in, 30 feet up in a spruce tree and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it varies. You know, it's funny. I have my local friends that have lived here their whole lives, and, the Youper culture, with road hunting and,
yeah.
So, it's just the way that they are, and it's what they've always done, and, I just try not to hunt on the trails, but, I'll have one of my buddies, I have access to his camp and a whole network, a labyrinth of logging roads. And he'll tell me, he's like, "Hey, hey, hey," he's up like on the weekends or whatever. I'm like, "Hey, hey, hey, me and my friends," like talking like five guys, all on a side by side, with their shotguns. It's like the orange Taliban, in a side by side, they drive around all day, and between all of them, they got like 20 birds. I was like, "Oh my God." Right. And us dog guys just have a hard time hearing that,
it's like in Maine too.
Yeah. Like, "All right," he's like, go over there." Right. So he gives me his waypoints where, lots of coveys, and I didn't shoot them all. I was like, they see a boatload of birds, and I go back there, like a week later, I'm like, "Oh, all right, I'll just wait a week, till I go back there." I go back there and, I find like one, and of course, I tell him he shot them all, but, it's really, crazy how they can swing based on, time, weather. I mean, again, there's always so many variables, but I guess there's a degree of unpredictability, but I don't know about you, but as far as it depends on which covers and how much hunting pressure, but certainly in New York, I always liked, if I was, if I didn't harvest anything, I'd like to give that cover like a week off maybe. And I'd cycle as I'm driving to another planned cover, I jump back in that cover for an hour or something a week later, to let the birds settle in. I don't know. When I was talking to Heather, on the show, probably more specific to here, we were talking about, territory size and stuff. And, she was saying like the males were, 10 to 50 acres, and the females might have some overlapping with the different male, territories up to like 100 acres. And, we were talking about how, in New York, especially in the mountains, if you're hunting like this abandoned farm country type stuff, the bird rockets out of the tree and could like coast to the other side of the, across the valley into the, like the hemlocks, stand that you see over there, depending upon, the elevation, the angle of the mountain, that kind of stuff. And,
yeah.
I don't know, out here, I swear that I've seen the same birds, like just from like my home birds that the dogs are just working, late summer into early season, I got six dogs on the ground. I'm just kind of pushing them through this contiguous habitat over decent distances. And certainly, I know if they're not pressured and they have super high quality habitat, they'll stay as local as you'll let them. But what's your experiences you feel in New York, you know, with covers, you know, our pocket covers, I feel kind of make the storyline a little different than the contiguous habitat. But I don't know, what's your experience with territory and thought on, you know, birds kind of jumping around these, you know, if they jump around different farms or not based on, you know, ability to move?
I would think kind of, you can almost think of some of these areas like a chocolate chip cookie, and they've got, you know,
that's a good one.
You know, that it's like a grouse could have, you know, a few different favored spots in its home range. As long as it can get from chip one to chip two to chip three kind of thing, you know, without being too exposed. Cause that's kind of some of the side hills and things. I someone had mentioned to me about, a grouse, you know, a little video clip of a dog pointing a grouse and how open it was. And it was like, yeah, that was an open area, but that was kind of like the cookie dough. And and where that bird actually was the chip. And it, where it wanted to go was to another bigger chip. Yeah. You know?
That's a great great visualization of New York grouse habitat.
Damn, I'm hungry all of a sudden.
Yeah. And I like chocolate, so we need to get some more chips in that cookie, that's for sure. But well, one other thing before we wrap this up, that I know I just find interesting with the grouse is color phases. You know, kind of like geographically, we see, you know, like your as you go down the eastern seaboard, you know, into those states, you know, that just, they got the red phase, you know, and then you get like Canada, they got, you know, a mostly gray phase. Even here in the Upper Peninsula, you get head more and more north and you have, you know, more gray phase. And in New York, we got a real mixed bag. But for me, on the, you know, more eastern side of the state, you know, I harvest a tremendous number of brown phase, which is something that we out here is in the mix, but it's the minority phase where I am. I'm just curious with your time in New York, if you know, you find that you harvest a lot of brown phase birds or see a lot of brown phase birds as well.
Yeah, a fair number. Yeah. Like, you know, whether it's the Adirondacks down through central New York.
Yeah.
They haven't really hunted over in the eastern part, you know. Mm-hmm. But and rarely a gray down, but sometimes a gray. And the neat thing about these birds is when they flush, if you get a glimmer of them going, it kind of, your eye picks up on what color bird that was.
Sure. But they're all big when they're in the sky. They're all big. Yeah. and then your dog brings it back and you're like, oh man, I thought it was bigger.
You know, just, I mean, really what you said, like Maine, a lot of grays up there. It was funny. I don't know, 15 years ago or so, I had rarely in northern Maine seen anything other than a gray. And then all of a sudden, one year, it's like, man, everybody's killing a redbird.
Yeah.
So it's like, I suspect that those red plumage chicks were in the, you know, that year they just happened to survive and do well, I think, as opposed to maybe in that environment, for whatever reason, they were dying.
Yeah.
I think they're throughout they're in the gene pool.
Yeah.
And some years, all of a sudden, boom, you got more of them than you ever had before. And it was fun in Maine that way, because like you say, the northern areas tend to have those gray birds. Oh, in Minnesota, wow, I was surprised how it's like Tutti Frutti. There's so many different, you know, they have to come up with new names for this new flavor. This new plumage. Well, not new plumage, but I mean, you had from red, brown, intermediate, gray, and on the females, you had split phase.
Where
you had a different color on the central tail feathers.
No, I you know, Michigan, Wisconsin, same, you know, where I do most of my hunting. And it's interesting you say about the red phase. I don't know. It might have been 2021. There was a significant uptick in red phase here as well. Mm-hmm. You know, so then of course I trying to ask locals and stuff if there's any kind of, you know, wives, old wives tales or myths about what does that mean for the population or something, you know, but there was a huge uptick there, but there is, I would also think, though, interesting that the further north you go where there's plenty of grouse and they seem to have mostly just gray face, you know, I don't know, just the genetic diversity within the gene pool, you know, as well, the, I mean, even within like the gray phase, I feel like the reds, I mean, they can have like their variety of like washout in color and stuff for sure. Right. You know, the extent of the gray phase here, like from being super dark gray, you know, almost like a blackish gray to, a hen that, I've given up on taxidermists, but the hen that I probably should have had mounted this year that I had taken in late October, she was such a washed out gray that, I mean, it was almost, it wasn't white, you know, but it was just unbelievable. Yeah, frosty, just an unbelievable color. And like her whole back going right down to her band on her tail. Yeah. And, you know, just, it's, it is amazing the, you know, spectrum of color that you can see in these birds.
There's at least two different theories on the gray, you know, spectrum to red. And so grouse do this. Screech owls also have, they've got, grays and reds. And then like red foxes, all the foxes for the most part that you see across the South, are red. I'm speaking of the red fox. Mm-hmm. The red foxes that you see in the Arctic, there's a lot of black ones and cross, and what, you know, they call cross fox, cross phase fox. But a lot of the dark pigmentations farther north, and I'm pretty sure, like, so with the with the screech owls, they looked at the structure of the feathers of the gray versus red, and the grays had better insulation properties than the red. I don't know if anyone's looked at that for ruffed grouse, but I'm pretty sure with the red foxes as well, the darker pelage was better insulation than the red. So that's, I mean, that could have something to do with it. The other thing is, of course, with the grouse, people are thinking, well, the reds are in more like oak type habitats. The grays are more in the aspen birch. So, you know, as far as cryptic coloration, you know, blending in with the surroundings.
Yeah, what survived.
So there could be a combination of things.
And, well, I can tell you that I do feel that, you know, here where I hunt, it's one of the, I feel that there's the number of types of species of vegetation that exists within a cover is, I feel, some of the most diverse, you know, and I don't know, maybe that's why we got such a colorful scheme, you know, across various parts of the lake states, but you know, color is always interesting. And just, man, the last few years I've seen quite the spectrum of it. And it's, it's almost one of those things that puts you in awe when you get to see them up close in your hand, you know,
Everyone's a 10 pointer.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So, well, Andy, we're going to wrap this up, but it's been a great conversation. I'm really happy we got to get you on the show and get everybody a little familiar with yourself and you with your dogs, and obviously getting the nerd out on grouse is always a fun thing to do. If you have any social media platforms, is there a place that our listeners could follow Andy and his red setters through the woods?
Basically the only thing I do right now is I'm on a few Facebook groups, the grouse dogs and some of those different bird dog groups, but
Okay.
yeah.
Sounds good. Well, I really appreciate you coming on the show. It was fun, and if you ever get out this way, give me a heads up. Maybe we can sneak out a day or something.
Will do, Kyle. It's been fun. Appreciate it. And I look forward to having Eric Blomberg on as well. That'd be
Yeah,
cool.
I'm gonna have to shoot Eric a text and say, hey, get him on here. So he sends me some updates, throughout his season and stuff with his younger dog. So yeah, for sure. Well, everybody, thanks for listening to Setter Talk today. Again, our guest is Andy Wyke, and as always, we tend to get into the dogs and often talk about grouse around here, but it was a great conversation. Till next time, give your setter a scratch on the head for me and make it a great day. Thanks so much.